This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
this hour's headlines, Joe Biden says President Donald Trump's refusal to accept his victory in the U.S. presidential election is an embarrassment. The official in charge of voter fraud investigations at the U.S. Justice Department resigns after Attorney General William Barr authorized federal prosecutors to probe possible election fraud. And the U.S. posts a new record in its daily COVID cases with nearly 202,000 new infections. Fatalities increased by over 1,500. Welcome to the program. U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign is planning to file a lawsuit in Michigan to prevent final certification of the state's election results. Trump's campaign attorney, Matt Morgan, says the effort seeks to make sure that no vote tally includes ballots cast fraudulently or unlawfully. That is actually the latest in a string of lawsuits the Trump campaign has filed to challenge Joe Biden's victory in the November 3rd presidential vote. U.S. media called the race on Saturday, but Trump insists that he is the winner and has made fraud claims without offering any evidence. Biden says Trump's refusal to concede defeat is an embarrassment. He says his team has already begun the transition process. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has ruled out the possibility of a transition to a new administration.
The United States has not been so divided in recent memory as there are two people claiming to be president. The mainstream media rushed to accept Joe Biden's declaration of victory, even though he has an average lead of only 32,000 votes in three states in a vote which is not even finished counting yet. Donald Trump has also claimed victory prematurely. It appears half the country believes Biden is the president-elect, while the other half believes Trump is the president-elect. No one knows what will happen next, and many fear tensions could elevate into violence.
Joe Biden has won. Trump may contest it, but the evidence is there. There is no illegal things regarding vote. The system has worked, and it will continue. One man will not ruin this system for us. Joe Biden is now our president.
And one thing I want to add, it's not Republican versus Democrat. We are Americans.
Special of our country.
Period.
But mail-in ballots were used in unprecedentedly massive numbers, and the vote's legality has been openly disputed for many months. It seems certain the courts will ultimately decide the legality of the vote, and maybe even who won, as in the year 2000, which caused massive political alienation, cultural division, and mistrust. The lack of trust is also because the U.S. election process is considered the worst of any of the core Western democracies. That's according to the Harvard-based Electoral Integrity Project, whose 2019 index ranked U.S. elections just 57th in the world. Pro-Biden corporate media is seemingly acting as if there is no dispute at all, while skeptical pro-Trump outlets insist this unique election must be vetted by the courts and that Trump must not concede before that process is finished.
I think he'll just give it up eventually. People will stop giving him airtime, stop giving him attention, and he'll just give up. He'll figure out another way to be in the news and all over the place.
Both sides appear to be bewildered by the stance of the other side, and both sides are certain of their own righteousness. With two presidents, many say the U.S. election could not have turned out worse, and the worst seems yet to come. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
Political commentator Frank Emsbach says there could be social unrest in the U.S. if Donald Trump continues to claim he won the presidential election.
Generally speaking, over the last 20 years or so, when you've had a recount, and let's say there's 20,000 difference or something like that, usually the recount only results in a 400 or 500 vote switch. So right now, as far as anybody knows, from the legal perspective, there's nothing on the table that would cause anybody to say the election is somehow invalid. What's happening, I think, is a very dangerous situation, because by refusing to acknowledge that there has been an election, that he has lost, And they keep talking about a smooth transition to the second Trump administration or whatever Secretary of State Pompeo said. That sets in motion, potentially, a situation of great social unrest. And I hope that's not what is going to happen here.
A top official from the U.S. Justice Department steps down in protest after Attorney General William Barr authorized federal prosecutors to probe possible election fraud. Richard Pilger was the director of the Elections Crimes Branch in the Justice Department. In his resignation letter, Pilger said Barr was revoking the 40-year policy of non-interference for ballot fraud investigations prior to elections being certified. On Monday, the U.S. Attorney General issued a memo allowing prosecutors to launch probes into what he called voting and vote tabulation irregularities. Prosecutors normally require permission from the Justice Department's Election Crimes Branch to investigate possible vote fraud before elections are certified. President Donald Trump has claimed, without providing any evidence, that his Democratic rival Joe Biden is projected the winner due to fraud. Ronnie Carvalho joined us earlier with the latest on U.S. President Donald Trump's legal challenges against the 2020 election results.
Some of the Trump followers are saying in the media that they do support whatever actions Donald Trump are taking in order to cancel some of the votes. So, okay, for those supporters saying that, but what I have is a position from different federal judges. The Pennsylvania, the case of Pennsylvania, the federal judge dismissed the request to stop counting. In Michigan, the judge rejected another lawsuit because they have no evidence. In Arizona, was another rejection. Trump's team wants to cancel some votes because some people use a different kind of Sharpies. In Georgia, the federal judge also rejected Trump's request because Trump's team wants to cancel some votes that was cast after 7 p.m. In Nevada, the federal judge also rejected a lawsuit there because Donald Trump wants to stop the county, the use of a machine, a verification machine.
The United States registers over 1,500 new deaths from COVID-19. That's a record in recent months as the country struggles to contain the spread of the pandemic. According to Johns Hopkins University's tally, the latest figure takes the country's total death toll to nearly 240,000. Meanwhile, the U.S., the world's worst-hit country in terms of both deaths and infections, on Tuesday announced more than 200,000 new infections. A large number is, however, assumed to be partly derived from data delayed over the weekend. So far, over 10.2 million people have been infected with the virus in the U.S. following the surge in cases and deaths. Several states across the Midwest tightened their restrictions. The coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc across Europe, with the number of COVID-19 deaths surpassing the grim milestone of 300,000 in the continent. Italy reports its highest daily death toll since April the 14th, registering nearly 600 coronavirus fatalities in a single day. Italian Health Ministry also reported over 35,000 new cases of the virus. The disease has now claimed a total of more than 42,000 lives out of nearly 1 million confirmed cases in the country. The UK also reported 530 new daily COVID-19 deaths, its highest toll since mid-May. So far, over 1.2 million confirmed cases of the virus have been reported in the country. In Poland, officials say the country should be shut down if new cases surpass 30,000. The United States has imposed fresh sanctions on a number of individuals and firms over their alleged link to a U.S. blacklisted Iranian firm. The U.S. Treasury Department said the restrictions target four people and six companies based in Iran, Hong Kong, Brunei, and China. They also accused of facilitating the procurement of sensitive goods, including U.S.-made electronic components, for Iran communication industries. The U.S. Treasury says the company produces military communication systems, avionics, and missile launchers, among other items. The move is the latest by the Donald Trump administration to ratchet up pressure on Iran. Tehran says Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign amounts to economic terrorism. Political commentator Mr. Jim Dean says President Donald Trump is trying to create hurdles for a Biden presidency in terms of its policies regarding Iran.
Anticipated this, and Trump and his campaign telegraphed this already in the news, that he was going to spend the whole next month doing a whole range of sanctions on Iran. He was going to be very busy during what should be a transitional period, where he's handing things over and laying out it, going into the background. He's wanting to, as part of his bitterness and losing the election, and then also while these court tests are going on until that silliness is over, he's going to, as part of his disrupting the Trump administration getting started up. So then he's also going to create Biden in, and by some of these sanctions, which I'm not sure of the legality, whether it's something that Biden can just reverse some of these new sanctions if he does. But I think another one of the reasons Trump's doing this is so that if Biden does reverse these sanctions when he takes office, the Republicans can then claim that he's going weak on Iran, and that he's not going to be tough enough like Trump said he was.
Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Russia have signed an agreement to end military conflict over the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. Thousands have died and roughly 100,000 have been displaced, but some say the deal is a betrayal.
After the deal was announced, people flooded the streets of Azerbaijan's capital to celebrate the end of the conflict and the gains made. Via the deal, Baku will hold on to areas of Nagorno-Karabakh that it took during the conflict, including the enclave's second city of Shusha, and between now and December 1st, ethnic Armenian forces must give up control of a slew of other territories.
I bow down in front of the families and mothers of the martyrs. We rejoice today at the cost of their children's blood. I bow down to them, that's all I can say.
However, over in Armenia there is no jubilation. Protesters have stormed the parliament, branding the prime minister a traitor and calling for him to resign. Although the leadership of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave says 1,200 of its defense forces have been killed and the main city of Stepanakert would have been lost within days if the fighting had continued, some say victory was possible. Armenia's prime minister says the deal was unbelievably painful but unavoidable.
Under the circumstances, making a different decision wasn't possible. I plan to give more details why it wasn't and tell everyone the reason behind last month's events. I can't do it right now for one simple reason, because we are in the process of stopping military action right now, and if I say something, I might endanger people.
Keeping a close eye on the conflict throughout, Iran, which shares borders with the disputed region, called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict that respected international law and the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the arrangement will pave the way for a lasting political settlement. For now, the battle is over, and thousands of people will now be left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Senior Palestinian official Saeb Erekat has died at the age of 65 due to coronavirus-related complications, weeks after being infected by the virus. Mr. Erekat was one of the Palestinians' most recognizable faces over the past decades. He served as a top Palestinian negotiator in talks with Israel.
Saeb Erekat was born in April 28, 1955 in Jerusalem al-Quds. He was just 12 years old when Israel occupied the West Bank and detained him a year later for his anti-Israeli efforts. Erekat attended a university in the U.S. and then moved to the U.K. for doctorate in peace and conflict studies. This was the beginning of Erekat's career for negotiations with Israel for the fate of a Palestinian statehood. His work as a negotiator dates back to the 1991 Madrid talks and then the Oslo Accords with Israel between 1993 and 1995. During the negotiations, he consistently voiced support for a two-state solution and opposed Israel's expansionism through settlement construction on the occupied territories. Erekat also served on top positions in the Palestinian Authority. He worked as a senior advisor to Yasser Arafat, former chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, as well as Mahmoud Abbas, the current Palestinian Authority president. Erekat has been the Palestinians' chief negotiator in talks with Israel for more than 20 years, but a controversy surrounded him with the 2011 publication of the so-called Palestine Papers. The leaked documents that included hundreds of confidential meetings and communications showed huge concessions offered by the Palestinian officials to the Israeli regime on key issues such as occupied East Jerusalem, the fate of refugees, and the right of return. He also shed light on the PA's security cooperation with Israel. The revelation forced Erekat to resign as chief negotiator, but he was appointed as a secretary general of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in 2015 and remained a key member of the Fatah movement, the most powerful faction within the PLO. Erekat was critical of recent U.S. brokered normalization deals, which saw the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain establishing full ties with Israel. He described the deal as, quote, the birth of Arab Zionism. He called the agreement a poisoned dagger stabbed into the Palestinians' back.
The 143rd birth anniversary of great Muslim philosopher and poet Dr. Allama Muhammad Iqbal has been marked across Pakistan. Iqbal's philosophical literature is considered as a leading source for unity among Muslims all over the world, regardless of their language, culture, or sect. Javed Rana is in Islamabad.
A guard of honor at the shrine of Dr. Allama Muhammad Iqbal in the eastern city of Lahore. It was 143rd birth anniversary of Iqbal, the ideological mind behind the creation of Pakistan in 1947. Iqbal, who died in 1938, extensively wrote against Western imperialism over Islamic world in the 20th century, when most of the Muslim world was under British, French and other Western colonial powers. Iqbal's poetry and philosophy evoked the passion of Islamic nationhood among Muslims of all colors, creed and sects living anywhere in the world. Prime Minister Imran Khan has vowed to seek guidance from Iqbal's philosophy in transforming Pakistan into an Islamic welfare country on the pattern of Islamic State of Medina, established by the last prophet of Islam over 14 centuries ago. Muhammad Iqbal has been the common ideological heritage not only in Pakistan but also in Turkey, Afghanistan, Iran, Central Asia and beyond. Many Iranians proudly bracket Iqbal with the legendary Persian poets and sought inspiration from his poetic literature for 1979's revolution. Iran's leader Ali Khamenei authored a book, Iqbal, the Poetic Philosopher of Islamic Resurgence. He describes Iqbal as a poetic genius. Through poetry and philosophical literature, Dr. Iqbal reminded the Muslim of the fact that their Islamic system of governance is a far more superior than that of Western secular democracy, and that is why he metaphorically described the Western democracy as shallow.
Democracy was an instrument which was used for the disintegration of the Muslim cultures and society. One thing and the other thing, and he also said that Western culture and society and civilization, in a nutshell, will commit suicide under the burdens of its own values and customs. And what are those values? Those values are blasphemy of prophets. And those values are nudity, and those values are a huge number of childbirths out of wedlocks.
Iqbal's literature from Urdu, Persian and English have been translated in more than 60 languages in the world to understand his philosophy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The The number of forcibly displaced persons around the world has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees has also gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019, compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Meanwhile, the European Union's new pact for migrants makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the EU's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Kemal Qureshi, M. Murat Erdogan, and Nihal Eminoglu, titled EU's New Pact on Migration and Asylum Missing a True Foundation. The article was published on Brookings.edu website. Please stay with us for more. On 23rd of September, the European Commission launched a new Pact on Migration and Asylum, proposing to overhaul the European Union's long-ailing policies in this area. European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas likened the pact to a building with three floors, comprised of an external dimension centered around strengthened partnerships with countries of origin and transit, robust management of external borders, and firm but fair internal rules. The Commission proposal must still make its way through the legislative process in the European Parliament and the European Council. The problem is the pact needs a foundational basement in the form of recognizing that an overwhelming majority of the world's refugees are hosted in developing countries. Without a basement, the whole edifice is undermined. The European Union must incorporate policy ideas from the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, to rectify this. The pact's external dimension, which calls for strengthening partnership with countries of origin and transit in the EU's immediate neighbourhood and beyond, is its ground floor. The second floor relates to policies to fortify and improve the management of the EU's external borders. The third floor proposes rules to resolve the long-standing challenge within the EU to achieve a more balanced distribution of responsibilities and promote solidarity among EU members in dealing with asylum seekers and refugees. At all three levels, the pact has faced intense pushback. With respect to the third floor, the Commission has been criticized for catering to the priorities of the more conservative and anti-immigrant member states such as Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia. The pact allows members to opt out from participating in the relocation of asylum seekers and refugees within the EU by offering them the possibility to instead provide administrative and financial support to other member states. Serious doubts have been expressed about the viability of this scheme. On the second floor, the big concern is that, once again, border security has been prioritized over access to asylum. while emphasizing the principle of non-refoulement as enshrined in international refugee law, the pact at the same time introduces measures that are clearly meant to complicate the possibility that individuals fleeing persecution and conflicts can seek to obtain protection in the European Union. A former director of the Center for Refugee Studies at Oxford University sees these measures as aiming to harden and formalize the fortress Europe. Migrants and refugees were to be kept out of Europe at all costs. The emphasis on protecting Europe's borders becomes most evident at the ground floor. Here the pact calls the revamping partnership with third countries and reflects the European Union's long-standing policy of externalizing the cost and responsibility of managing its external borders. Tying policy issues such as development assistance, trade concessions, security, education, agriculture, and visa facilitation for third country nationals to those countries' willingness to cooperate on migration management has long been criticized as asymmetrical. The pact takes this relationship to a new coercive level by suggesting the possibility of applying restrictive visa measures to third countries unwilling to be cooperative. Time will tell whether these problems on each floor will be addressed as the Commission proposal makes its way through the legislative process. However, there is a deeper structural problem to the pact, resulting from the missing basement. This is because the pact fails to account for two major global realities confronting the European Union. The problem is that the pact is so inward-oriented that it fails to recognize the policy implications of the dire state of forced migration globally. The number of forcibly displaced persons has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million individuals. According to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees alone has gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019, compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Secondly, the pact makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the European Union's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. The Economist and the United Nations have noted that the pandemic risks undoing the gains made against poverty in the past 2 decades. According to the World Bank, most affected will be developing countries, where more than 85% of these refugees are hosted. This picture is likely to erode the capacity of these countries to cope with the presence of refugees and manage public resentment as competition for scarce resources between refugees and locals intensifies. Under these circumstances, it would not be unrealistic to expect pressures for secondary movements towards the EU to build up, reminiscent of the ones that occurred during 2015 and 2016. The European Union has an interest in recognizing the reality presented by the basement floor and should supplement policies on the first floor and above accordingly. A former UNHCR official points out the pact hardly makes any reference to the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, but it could be a so-called inspiring source of policy ideas. The idea of the Global Compact on Refugees emerged from the September 2016 United Nations Summit in New York that was held to address the challenges resulting from the European migration crisis. Adopted in December of 2018, the Global Compact on Refugees recognizes that the traditional refugee protection system based on the 1951 Geneva Convention is under duress, if not broken. Against this reality, it calls on the international community to work together in the spirit of burden and responsibility sharing to improve the self-reliance of refugees and the resilience of their host communities, as well as help hosts transform refugees from being a humanitarian burden to a development and economic opportunity. All European Union member countries apart from Hungary have endorsed the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees. Though the pact fails to acknowledge the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees, the European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas promises to seek global solutions and responsibility sharing with international partners on migration, as well as proposes to establish a union resettlement and humanitarian admission framework regulation that would provide a stable EU framework for the European Union contribution to global resettlement efforts. These reflect at least the spirit of the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees. However, the European Union needs to go beyond this and heed to the Global Compact on Refugees' call to promote economic opportunities, decent work, job creation and entrepreneurship programs for host community members and refugees in refugee hosting countries. Then can the European Union enjoy a solid basement floor for the rest of the pact. The Global Compact on Refugees offers a rich array of innovative policy suggestions that the European Union can take into consideration when negotiating partnerships with countries hosting large numbers of refugees. One such policy idea calls for a more active involvement of the private sector in supporting self-reliance of refugees through decent and sustainable employment. In its partnership agreement, the European Union could include terms incentivizing companies to offer such opportunities for refugees. This could be enabled by extending preferential trade arrangements for countries hosting large numbers of refugees, which is something the Global Compact on Refugees mentions. Such partnerships with the European Union could be conditioned to refugees being offered sustainable employment opportunities. The advantage of all this is that the resulting economic growth would also benefit host communities, support social cohesion, and help empower already fragile economies coming out of the COVID-19-induced economic recession. It would also give the partnerships that the European Union is advocating for at the ground floor of the pact a much more solid foundation based on a cooperative spirit rather than the current formulation. In this way, the new pact would help create a win-win-win outcome, benefiting refugees, benefiting the host countries, and benefiting the EU.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. My name is Saeed Pureza. Straight to our top story on this broadcast. Armenia and Azerbaijan have signed an agreement to end 6 weeks of military conflict over the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. The announcement has led to anger in Yerevan, but celebration in Baku. Armenia's prime minister says he had to make an unspeakably painful decision, but one that could not have been avoided. Bianca Rahimi reports.
After the deal was announced, people flooded the streets of Azerbaijan's capital to celebrate the end of the conflict and the gains made. Via the deal, Baku will hold on to areas of Nagorno-Karabakh that it took during the conflict, including the enclave's second city of Shusha, and between now and December 1st, ethnic Armenian forces must give up control of a slew of other territories.
I bow down in front of the families and mothers of the martyrs. We rejoice today at the cost of their children's blood. I bow down to them, that's all I can say.
However, over in Armenia, there is no jubilation. Protesters have stormed the parliament, branding the prime minister a traitor and calling for him to resign. Although the leadership of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave says 1,200 of its defense forces have been killed and the main city of Stepanakert would have been lost within days if the fighting had continued, some say victory was possible. Armenia's prime minister says the deal was unbelievably painful but unavoidable.
Under the circumstances, making a different decision wasn't possible. I plan to give more details why it wasn't and tell everyone the reason behind last month's events. I can't do it right now for one simple reason, because we are in the process of stopping military action right now, and if I say something, I might endanger people.
Keeping a close eye on the conflict throughout, Iran, which shares borders with the disputed region, called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict that respected international law and the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the arrangement will pave the way for a lasting political settlement. For now, the battle is over, and thousands of people will now be left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Bianca Rahimi, London.
John White is an author and political commentator, joining me now with expert analysis of what's happening in the South Caucasus. Good to see you again, John. So Azerbaijan is taking this as a victory, but with Turkey's backing and the use of foreign militants, there's allegations of the use of cluster munitions. What kind of precedent does this set for the region, do you think?
Well, good evening, Saeed. I think it sets a very dangerous precedent because this is all the trappings of a Carthaginian peace where one side has been humiliated, and another side is wallowing in triumphalism. And so I think the danger is that this peace agreement will only plant the seeds for future conflict. We see this reflected in the anger that's been unleashed by Armenians in Yerevan, storming the country's parliament. Armenia has a very fragile democracy. It's only a few years old. We have to see how the Armenian military takes this leadership, and it does seem to me that the Prime Minister, Mr. Pashinyan, has done a poor job in communicating with the Armenian people and bringing them on board. Well, it was a very, very humiliating day for many Armenian patriots.
And as far as this peace deal, we've seen ceasefires before that were violated. Do you think this one will hold, considering it seems to have more weight behind it?
Yeah, well, the role of Russian and peacemakers and peacekeepers will be key. Russia's taken it very seriously. It's committed, I think, 1,600 Russian troops to keep the peace between the contending parties. But I will have to see, as I say, how the Armenian military leadership takes this. I've not heard anything meaningful from that quarter as yet, because there will be a lot of disquiet within the ranks. They've lost a lot of men. And for what? That's the question that they'll be asking themselves right now.
Right. Some 2,000 Russian troops to be deployed with a 5-year mandate. And then there's Turkey, as I mentioned earlier, its reliance on imports of oil or energy. And then we're looking at Turkey's footprints everywhere, now in the South Caucasus, in Libya, in Syria, elsewhere. What is the drive behind this? Energy, or is there something else at play here?
It's energy, and it's also national prestige. Mr. Erdogan, I think it's clear, sees Turkey as a major player in the region, and he wants to assert that role. I think he suffers from the delusion that he carries a bigger stick than he actually owns. He certainly needs to be careful of the oil transshipment routes that bring oil and gas from Russia and the Caspian Sea down to Turkey. But Turkey's just discovered sizable deposits of oil and gas in the Black Sea and off its own shores. So perhaps until those are developed, he will continue to see Central Asia as a key geostrategic region, and he'll act accordingly.
All right. John White with that great analysis. John, thank you as always. And now moving on. Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz says the European Union must band together against what he calls political Islam.
Terrorismus, das ist die Tat selbst.
There needs to be a coordinated fight against political Islam, against the basis of the ideology that forms this aggression against our society, against our Western way of life. And this is critical, because as long as this ideology exists, there will be young people who will end up radicalized. There will be hate preachers who perhaps won't carry out terror attacks themselves, but will encourage others to do so.
The Chancellor's comments come just a week after attack fury extremists opened fire on people in the Austrian capital, Vienna, killing 4 and injuring several others. Prior to this, French President Emmanuel Macron said France is against what he called Islamist separatism and that Islam was in crisis across the world, comments that drew outrage and condemnation from Muslims worldwide. To the skyscraper-studded Persian Gulf Arab Sheikhdom of the UAE, it has relaxed Islamic laws on alcohol and cohabitation and criminalized honor killings. I'll let Robert Carter give you all the details. Robert, good to see you.
Thanks, Aid. So obviously, the United Arab Emirates is going through a period where it's being heavily criticized by the Ummah, by the Islamic world. This news obviously comes very shortly after they decided to sign a deal to recognize Israel, which of course has Arab blood on its hands. It's been oppressing Muslims for a very, very long time. And following this latest development, they're also reforming laws to bring the country further away from its Islamic roots. This, of course, is totally intolerable for the many Muslims who have for a long time criticized this regime for being essentially a Western-backed satellite in the heartland of Islam. So let's just take a very quick look at some of the laws which are going to be reformed. The drinking alcohol in public will be legalized. Couples being able to live and mingle with one another in private before marriage will also be legalized. Some other reforms are being brought in which sound good on the surface, like honor killings, which are going to be officially criminalized and things like that. But ultimately, how this is being taken by the Muslim world is that the UAE is essentially positioning itself closer with the West, and that in a period where Islam is being persecuted worldwide, this essentially un-Islamic regime that rules the United Arab Emirates is using it as an opportunity to attack Islamic values. The region should remain traditionalist in its Islamic views.
And the last time we talked about something like this, Robert, was I think back in July of this year, about the Saudi ambassador to the UK and his residence and him bragging about a pub where he lives.
Yes, that's a very good point. So the UAE is falling in line with its regional dictatorial partners such as Saudi Arabia, which again looks to the West rather than the East and rather to its Muslim and Islamic partners in the region. So certainly there are many concerns that the UAE is going to follow suit, and Saudi Arabia may start to initiate new regimes as well,
right,
a very un-Islamic nature going forward.
People have had a lot to say about this.
Online reaction has been a considerable. So the first tweet I have, it's from Al Kanadia, who says, "So glad I don't live there in the UAE. Yeah, I said it. I would rather live in a Western country than live in a country that's managed by munafiqs. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala deal with them in the severest manner, and better make Hijrah to a Muslim country instead of that dump." So some critical advice there for the Muslim Ummah. Then the next tweet I have from Don Solo says that it's still not worth celebrating reforms. How about the UAE work on their human rights laws and stop suppressing their citizens' voice? And then third and final tweet from Zain says that the UAE has abandoned Palestine, is attacking Yemen, and is now turning its back on Islam. This Western-backed regime wants to keep the Arabs weak and erode Islam from its historic heartlands. I think that final tweet sums up the story very well.
It definitely does. Let's move on to your second story. A call by Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, on regional countries for dialogue.
Yes, certainly. So the Islamic Republic of Iran obviously is looking at the region now with a fresh lens, given the fact that U.S. foreign policy, which heavily influences part of that region, is likely to change going forward, given the fact that Donald Trump has lost the recent presidential election. So there's a lot of speculation now about how the region will change. Biden has criticized Saudi Arabia in his election bid. He's also pledged to end the war in Yemen and to potentially even renegotiate a U.S. re-entry into the JCPOA. Those are all things that are being thought about now, could change going forward. And Iran has stepped up and essentially said that, look, let's not look to the U.S. too much and focus on what they're doing. Iran is ready. We're here to negotiate. We're here to cooperate. And now let's bring down tensions in the region. Now that we've got rid of that despotic Trump from the White House, who's very pro-war and very unpredictable, Iran is ready to negotiate and bring about a peaceful transition to the region, inshallah. And I actually have the tweet itself from the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, which we can pick up now. So Zarif says on Twitter, "A sincere message to our neighbors. Trump's gone in 70 days, but will remain here forever. Betting on outsiders to provide security is never a good gamble. We extend our hand to our neighbors for dialogue to resolve differences. Only together can we build a better future for all." So a very positive message being sent out from the Islamic Republic to hopefully try and bring about a new era after Trump's passing from power.
Thinking,
hopefully that will benefit the region going forward.
Right.
Let's wait and see.
Correct. I'm thinking the leadership in some of those regional countries should be mourning right about now, knowing that Trump and Pompeo won't be in power in 70-something days from now. But I see you have picked two very interesting tweets on this story. Let's have a look at those.
Absolutely. So also occurring recently on Twitter is it appears that the Trump regime has been lashing out after the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, mocked the scandalous U.S. election as being a complete and utter mess.